Welcome into the show. Today, we decided, you know, the season's creeping up. We're middle of summer. That football hype is going to start to build soon. We should probably grab a credentialed, real professional in the space to help us talk Iowa football and expectations for the 2024 season. We've got Scott Docterman on the show today. We don't just talk football, though. We also talk his career in journalism, covering Caitlin Clark, a bunch of other topics as well. You're going to love it. Let's have a day. Let's go. Welcome into the Wash Up Walk-Ons podcast. Another episode, another guest in this summer lineup of guests. Kind of been hitting on all cylinders here. We got Spencer Lee, Coach Woods, and now another guy that I would argue is as respected as those two in his field. Scott Docterman joins the show today. We haven't delved into the media side, the actual professionals who cover the Hawkeyes too much. We've had iCold on before. Right before all the stuff happened in 2020, we actually had Mark Morehouse on, shortly before he hung it up. Scott, you, I think you're the third one we've had on. And as I said, I don't know if there's a more respected, at least from my perspective, on Twitter and just kind of being in the space now after, in a post playing career. I don't know if there's anybody more respected, by the general fan base than you when it comes to covering the Hawkeyes. So we really appreciate your time tonight and coming on the show.
Thanks for the kind words. I really appreciate it. You know, it's been fun. I've been covering the team now 18 straight years. I did some in the 90s too, after I graduated from Western Illinois. And you know, your podcast was must listen material back in 2020. I think it was some of the more important podcasts that have ever came about in this space. And obviously, you guys have done a tremendous job over the last handful of years of kind of filling that podcast vacuum and leading the way. So congratulations on all your success here.
Appreciate that. I don't know what Kevin would say about that. I will say that I think we got pretty lucky. Just when there's a niche that isn't filled and you're the only person, that helps. There's not a lot of competition for the style and perspective that we bring. So that certainly has added to the success. Our third guy who hasn't been on the show for almost going on a year now certainly helped that in a different way, as being kind of the fireball of the three of us. But we appreciate that. The 2020 was certainly a challenging year, I think, is a good word.
Definitely, Kev, you can not an easy time to have a public voice.
Yeah. We actually started this, and I'm sure you've dealt with similar things, being the voice behind a lot of the stories that you've written in a 2-decade-plus career, just for the team. I didn't know you'd been covering 18 years. That's actually awesome. You're basically, you've almost got the whole KF tenure, which is really, really cool. We just wanted to be a fun voice, bring entertainment, and, you know, like reminisce on some memories. And then in 2020, things turned, and all of a sudden we were being looked at. Gosh, in 2020, we were still only like 25 years old. I wouldn't call myself fully matured or developed at all at that point. And all of a sudden people were looking at us for like, hey, how should we feel about this? How, you know, what are your thoughts? What were your guys' experiences? And it was certainly, I don't know if Kevin remembers, but before that first episode back when all that stuff happened and came out, I don't think I've ever sweat more in my life turning the record button on that night. That was interesting. Kev, any thoughts on that?
I mean, thinking back at it now, it's like, yeah, you kind of said it right. It's like, who are we to be the ones to have the public opinion on this, right? Exactly. Yeah. Like we're just three guys that had our own experience, right? It's like, we can't speak for what everyone else did, but we you know, at the end of the day, we just spoke our truth, right? So it was definitely a little nerve-wracking for sure, seeing how it would be received by the public. Looking back at it, maybe we made a bigger deal of it in our heads than it actually was, but I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
It was an interesting time. Interesting time. Like Clarissa said, like, we didn't start this podcast to get into serious stuff like that.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to talk politics.
Talk some football, have some fun, you know, talk to the old buddies and from our playing days. And then, yeah, exactly. You're kind of forced to make a public statement. It's not exactly comfortable.
It was a turbulent summer, not just in the Iowa ecosystem, but nationally as well, with all the George Floyd stuff. It was on my list tonight, covering the story, covering Doyle 2020, all of that. From your perspective, Scott, how do you even go about that when you start to see that unfold? And as a former player and just now fan of the team, someone who also creates content around the team, we got to witness how you and every other media entity went about reporting it. I like some other than others, and everybody has their own way of going about that. But when you start to see the tweets, you know, I think it was James who sent out the first tweet, and then other players start to share their experiences. How does that even start to, because it's not just, you're in a weird spot because you've got a story now. How does that start to come together?
Well, it was clearly, when it comes to football, it was the most challenging, or you know, sports in general, is the most challenging subject I've ever covered, because there are multiple layers. You're talking about people's lives, and I think you need to take it with that kind of seriousness, and meaning that from every end of the spectrum, we're talking about people's lives. We're talking about Chris Doyle, Kirk Ferentz, on, you know, to what you guys experienced, to what other people may have experienced, to what African-American young men have experienced and where they're from. And everybody's experience is a little bit different. And we got I would not say a front row seat, but we got a seat to watch some of it unfold. So we, you know, I came with a little bit of a perspective where I understood a few of the issues, but not the whole fire hose of the issues that came out that night. Obviously, we all knew we had a story. I was actually on vacation, and I'm like, okay, vacation's over with now, you know? And so started going through who said what, trying to verify a little bit of what you can verify, but really there's no way to do that in that kind of a fashion. So you compile it, you write it the best you can for what it is at that first day. And then the next day you take another step, and then you take another step, and to try to verify those stories, check in, make sure, talk to those players, talk to other people, and go step by step by step by step. And it's, again, it was very difficult because I think there was a lot of shock. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of anger. There was a lot of frustration and bewilderment. And you throw that against the backdrop of what had happened with George Floyd, you know, less than 2 weeks before that, along with it being a COVID year, just so many, the confluence of so many different things coming at the same time, you know, added that level of enhanced challenges and difficulties. And then going forward, though, once the tweets kind of subsided and you knew that they were going to hire Hush Blackwell, that Chris Doyle had been placed on administrative leave, and then ultimately the separation agreement. That was the time when I wanted to get to the kind of the bottom of the story. And what some people preferred to do it is let everybody tell their stories, whether it was unfiltered or whatever. I chose kind of a different path, and that was I wanted players, current African-American players, their parents, and former African-American players to guide me. And not just those who are disgruntled, or not just those who share their story, but other ones who maybe decided not to. So I reached out probably, I mean, it was between 75 and 100 different players, their parents. Tell me what you think. Tell me, you know, on or off record. I just want a baseline here because it kind of handles the angle with which you report. And very quickly, in most of the conversations I had, that most of the people were, you know, were saddened by this. I didn't think it was this bad. We think Kirk deserves a chance to make this right. We're not sure he can, but he deserves that chance. But they seem to be, the majority seem to be, you know, against Chris Doyle. And so, and in some ways, that kind of tenor shaped some of the coverage that I wanted to write, because I also needed to be fair, as I said, because your experiences are different than their experiences. I'm from Burlington, Iowa. My experiences, even covering the team, is different than somebody who's from Chicago or Detroit or whatever. So I'm a white guy. I'm 50 now, unfortunately. You know, we've got all these different factors that you got to take into account. And then at the same time, I flashed the mirror on myself. Was there anything that I saw that I could have done, that I could have done differently? And I came to that conclusion that no. And the reason why is, as a journalist, in 2017, probably the one moment that stuck out in my mind was on senior day. There were three African-American players who walked. And it was, you had Akram, and you had Miles Taylor, and you had James Butler, who was a transfer. And I thought, this just doesn't look very good, you know, that, yep, you know, this number of players. So that stuck out in my mind, but I kept thinking, is there anything I could have done? Well, I think the backdrop of George Floyd allowed people to say what they feel a little more freely than maybe they would have earlier. I could not have gotten that kind of reaction from that broad of a base. The secondly, if they would have told me, it would have been off the record and I would have gotten roasted. I mean, I would have gotten pulverized. If I would have said 15 players said this about Chris Doyle, would have got pulverized by the fan base. Why are you bringing this up? You know, former players, I don't understand what you're doing here. And then inside the building. So I came to the conclusion that the only way that this subject could have been discussed publicly was the way that which it was. And they were able to do it in their own way, which I think was the right way. And so therefore, from there on, I had to cover it that way. The more the summer got, the more difficult it became, and more the fingers started getting pointed at me. Why are you guys writing about this and that? But overall, I felt like I was fair. Some people didn't think I went far enough. Other people thought I went too far. But overall, I was kind of proud of what I wrote that summer.
Yeah. Suffice to say, at least the way you describe it, it has to be, maybe you can tell me differently, in your all your years in this profession, maybe the toughest, touchiest subject you've ever had to write about?
No question. Yeah. When you're talking about race, it's a level, you know, especially being, like you said, a white man from Iowa, yeah, I have to be very careful. I mean, yeah, one wrong word in a tweet or something I say on a podcast or a radio show could be turned viral and ultimately get me fired for life, you know? Yeah. So, you know,
we felt the same, a little bit of that. I mean, Kevin's from Illinois, but yeah, you're muted, by the way, Kevin, if you're trying to say something. Kevin's from Illinois, but he's a Iowa transplant. We consider him now. Yeah. And
also the only one currently employed by a, you know, Fortune 500 company,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
might not have liked something I would have said.
Kevin, the only one with real ramification. If we, like you said, you know, one wrong word or way to describe something and it gets, mm-hmm, construed the wrong way. So we felt some of that pressure as well. And then, as you mentioned, things continue to go on and time goes on. And now you're starting to get blowback of like, you didn't do enough or you did too much. Same thing with us. I can't tell you how many messages we got or how many comments under our YouTube video of like, why are you guys talking about it? Why aren't you guys talking more about it? Like, it almost felt like you couldn't win.
No, there was no winning. You're whatever you said, if you were on one side, the other side tried to toe it down the middle, tried to be fair and objective, like you're going to upset some people. Yeah. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts around it. You know, and that kind of leads into my next question is like, when you're on a hot topic like that, like, you know, obviously we're all passionate about football and Iowa football, you know, but when you're reporting on a topic such as this, like, it can be very easy to maybe kind of step into leading the story where maybe you want it to lead versus where you try to find the actual truth. Like, tell me a little bit more about, like, you kind of went into it a little bit, like how you went through your process, but like, obviously, like, if you just follow like these set of stories, you can come up with a completely different set, a story than if you follow like a group of different player stories, right?
Yeah, it's, and that's what I try to do. And I've covered, luckily for me, I have a history where I've covered politics, I've covered murders, I've covered all these different things. I was a police reporter for a while. And so I have kind of this background that allows me to kind of shed some of those images or the perceptions or whatever you want to say, biases, when I go into a story, especially one like this. But the weight of the situation, the gravity of the situation was always with me. And it was always like, if depending on what I write, it is going to shape public opinion in some way, shape or form against somebody or on the other side. So I really chose my words as carefully as I could, but I felt like the right path for me for this topic was to talk to the people who are most affected. Mm-hmm. And that was somebody who, you know, they're from Indianapolis or St. Louis or whatever, and they sent their young African-American son to Iowa City and they're removed 4-6 hours away. What are their thoughts of the situation? How is their son impacted? What do they think going forward? And what are their, you know, their expectations beyond this? And that's why I tried to use them as the barometer. And not one person, but multiple people kind of point me in this direction. Where do I think this story needs to go? And so that way I don't stray. I don't just talk to somebody who's like a diehard supporter or somebody who's anti Ference Doyle, whatever. And then somebody who's like, hey, he did no wrong. He did nothing wrong there. You know, okay. They're maybe on the fringe, but I wanted to try to keep it on the fairway per se. And that's why I really went down this path. And every interview I did, find respected players, players that I knew that if they said something, it meant something. Not, again, somebody was there for a semester and bolded and, you know, didn't work hard. And we all know that, you know, because I just don't really have the time for that. Mm-hmm. I want somebody that if I talk to them, they're like, yeah, that guy has a good, you know, he played 5 years. Yeah. He bled for this team. He had surgeries.
That was what was tough for us, I think, from the former player's perspective, especially because most of these self accounts that came out were, I mean, almost entirely from our tenure there. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were those kind of guys, like semester 1 year guys who came in, and at least from our perspective on the inside, like it was very clear. Part of the reason that they weren't there very long is because they didn't work hard or, you know, something that was completely, there was no bias to it. It was like, everybody knows that you weren't doing what you're supposed to. Seeing those muddy the water with some of the actual, mm-hmm.
Almost weaken the,
Yeah. It's like, if there's something actually here,
yeah,
you guys aren't helping the cause here. So it was weird coming, you know, kind of dealing with that as well.
Like, you know, in the beginning when there was like all over Twitter, right? And now it's like there's some reporters out there that are just like every tweet gets a write up, everything gets an unfiltered. I'm like, is that really the best way to get into it, right?
And that's what I was kind of gonna ask Scott, was like, with social media, it gets dicey there. Like,
it gets emotional, right? And
do you retweet every single player that says something? It like, or do you not retweet anything? Do like, how do you know? Cause if, you know, like you said, Scott, people take your word as how they're going to form their opinion. You're respected. You have all these followers. You're, you know, a dedicated, established reporter for the Iowa Hawkeyes. What Scott Docterman says is going to help me kind of sway whatever way I want to sway. If he retweets this player who's got this gripe, does that mean the gripe is real? Like, is that's a really tough place for you in the world of Twitter and social media that wasn't around when you started your career? You didn't have to deal with any of that. That, I mean, and that's part of my, you know, one of the bigger topics on here too, is kind of the shift just in media in general from everything was written, you know, eventually the
online.
Yeah. Moving to online. And now Scott's on a podcast with us where, you know, 15 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, podcasts were just starting to. I know you and Morehouse had a podcast, correct?
Oh yeah.
And absolutely. it was an OG podcast. Mm-hmm. You guys started it back in 11?
2010, actually. 10? Yeah.
So you guys,
Iowa podcast.
We should really be thanking you for pioneering the field. That's where this has really come. But kind of crazy that you now have to deal with it in a way that now I have this social media presence as a reporter, and that affects public opinion. Not only what I write will matter to the people, but what I just put out on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram will also matter. It's kind of a crazy thing that you have to deal with.
For sure. And, you know, when it comes to those gripes or any others that come down the road, I mean, I think anybody who wears the black and gold and the Tiger Hawk and says something, it's newsworthy, sure, whether it's right or wrong, or it's 100% true, 50% true, or barely a shade of true. It's all newsworthy. So you do have to take that into account. And now I may not verbatim retweet somebody. I may just quote tweet them in some respects to say, sure, this is what this player said about this situation.
Retweet the endorsement.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I don't want to just make it look like I'm retweeting everybody. And again, cause I want to make sure there's validity, because as we've seen, even when the story came out, even when all those tweets were up, I mean, how many were absolutely true? How many of them were embellished? How many of them were flat out lies? There's a range there. And
the
then,
mix,
when, yeah. And then when you had, I think it was Robert T. Greene that was going through that and representing players. And then you look at the lawsuit I've looked through, I have every single document in that lawsuit. So I've looked through the 533 page document when the attorney general wanted to dismiss Chris Doyle from the suit. And I read through every deposition and how many, most of those depositions really refuted everything that they're claimed. And so you have to take that all into account. And in some ways, that's what I kind of saw in the very beginning, which is why I want to be fair, why I want to be straight down the middle. I don't want to provide my opinion on any of this. I want to keep it as narrow as I can, because in the end, what we saw was that there were several people who were affected, and their opinions absolutely need to be presented. There was change that needed to take place in the Iowa football program, and I think it has successfully, for the most part, at least from my perspective. Then there were a lot of people who devalued those opinions, the actual problems that took place, by embellishing, by lying, and then the lawsuit. If the University of Iowa wouldn't have settled, they may have gone to court and they may have won. So I think that's why I want to try to take this all in perspective, that it's easy. And in my environment where I work now at The Athletic, which we're connected with the New York Times, and so therefore I'm part of big media now, and you look at the ESPNs and everybody else like that, it's really easy to grab onto something, something like that, and say, racist, get rid of them, do that. But I'm like, no, let's take a look at this. If the information collected leads you to that conclusion, then that's fair. But if it's anecdotal, if it's just a couple of people, if it's a couple of disgruntled people who say that they heard one word, but really it wasn't that word, is that you're totally wiping out a career for somebody. And I thought that was, that I wanted to be fair. And ultimately, I felt pretty confident in what I reported. And I feel confident today.
Yeah. I think I
from the outside looking in, I was curious, like when the Hush Blackwell and the lawsuit all came, like all the documents were unsealed. What was your takeaway? I won't say opinion. What was your general takeaway from the Hush Blackwell and the lawsuit files that were all just from the outside looking in? I mean, I imagine 98% of Iowa fans didn't actually read it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I kind of look at them in different veins, and that's kind of like this whole situation, why it makes it so complicated, is that for everybody like Imani Hooker who tweets, I respect his opinion because I know what he did, and seeing it and understanding it, I kind of get it. The Hush Blackwell report I did take very seriously, and I think the amount of interviews and the professionalism that they conducted, I thought was right. But then when you look at the lawsuit and you look at these interviews and read through them and everything, I saw accusations where the depositions didn't meet the accusations. that there were, you know, I don't know if I want to go so far as to call them lies, but I would say, yeah, go ahead. But
we got a couple former teammates that put out some pretty serious lies.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the situation with Jonathan Parker and throwing the football and then taping, you know, his conversation with Kirk Ferentz and then trying to say that only, you know, a blank would run like that. And then it's like, but nobody heard that happen, but you continue to say it and it becomes like a headline in every single situation from the attorney, everything they contact us with. And so it gets perpetuated and then ultimately it sticks. And so I was not, you know, the more I read of it, the less I was like, okay, this is a money grab. You know, yeah. That's what it is. I mean, what they were asking for and what you knew that they wanted to settle. And I know all along I'd talk to people with it. And the first thing that they would do in every single conversation, the attorneys would say, hey, you ready to settle now? And because that's all they wanted. And of course he got half, you know, like $2.5 million. And the rest got split up like 13 different ways, like 100. And, you know, it's kind of like, man, you sold who you are in some ways for that for $130,000 because, you know, that it's, you know, now you can't come back.
Nope.
Now you're not welcome back. And
they're not welcome back. And I'll say this within, you know, a circle like Kevin and I are in, just as a, you know, the former, you know, alum, like can't come back there either.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not just that though. I mean, if like you actually want to go on and have a career, like the Iowa football alumni network is how I got my job. And just the Iowa alumni network in general is like, you can very well network that to find a career that you want.
Yeah.
And you pretty much just shut the door on that.
Yeah.
Like, no one's going to take your phone call.
Yeah. I think to wrap this up, because I don't want to make this all a somber, like, oh, 2020 yeah. downer podcast.
Sure.
I think what I hate the most about it is, at least it feels like, especially when you're on the app, Twitter is everything, right? Like, Twitter is real life. Whatever I read here is like, no one even fact checks anything anymore, which probably drives you crazy, Scott. You tweet something and it blows up. People just take it for what it is. They don't even ask questions. And in this sort of scenario, I think where this whole thing ended up, at least my perspective, is that, and this is where most people don't like to end up, is it's not just Chris Doyle, bad, racist, hated African-American athletes, only like the white guys. It's not just, nope, everything was good. There was nothing going on. It's somewhere in the middle. Where, you know, it probably there wasn't as much malicious intent here as a lot of people make it out to be, but there's also, it wasn't just 100% roses, and people don't like the middle because the middle isn't a headline. It's not something you can use as a buzzword for a title of a story. And that's what people want nowadays. And it's really unfortunate because like you said, people's lives, reputations are tagged to this, and it's, you know, unfortunately just sort of the way it goes. But we'll move on from that. I want to quickly bring it back to, you mentioned 18 years covering the team. Did you always know you were going to be a journalist? Like, was this the dream from when you were 16 years old, sitting sophomore year of high school? Like, I want to cover sports. Or was there another path for you? You mentioned you went to Western Illinois. Is that the Leathernecks?
Mm-hmm.
Holy smokes. we actually had a former teammate transfer there. Trev. Remember that, Kev?
Mm-hmm.
Trev went and played for us in Illinois for a couple of years, I think.
FBI now or something. He's doing
something. I do believe he's an FBI agent now, so that's pretty cool. So was it always the thing?
I wanted to play pro football, man.
who didn't? All right.
That was my first goal.
I tried
really hard, but I couldn't win the quarterback job as a sophomore, and I've realized that I better get on to plan B pretty quick. I did stick it out all the way through and had some of the best memories of my life playing high school football when Burlington was in the MAC instead of falling down a class. But anyway, I digress. I'd always kind of liked to write a little bit. And then I took a journalism class my sophomore year of high school. And I actually found out I was pretty good at it, that I, you know, for that level and kind of the first thing that came, you know, I'm like, oh, well, this isn't so bad. And I was doing a, writing a couple of stories and for the high school newspaper, doing some fun stuff there. And then I was, I was playing football. I wrestled for a while, but then I punched the wall. I lost a wrestle off and I broke my hand so severely I had to have surgery, and it still bothers me today. I still can't even like close a glove for, and I can't play the guitar anymore because of it, you know, because, you know, I was stupid enough to punch the wall. But, and then, tried soccer, but I told the story the other day. I never played before. My senior year, I decided, all right, I'm going to play soccer. I became the backup goalie. And then my aunt worked at the Hawkeye newspaper in Burlington and got me a job as a part-timer taking calls. A week after I took that job, the starting goalie got shot in Burlington. So I would have had, I would have been the starting goalie that week, but because he had, and so they ended up letting. I know.
He got hurt, so I had to get. No, he got shot.
He got shot.
It's not funny, but the way you told it is funny. Wow, that's a story. Holy smokes.
Yeah. And so he, so I would have started. I'm like, damn, I should stay with it. But they let me actually go out and accept a forfeit one time when the other team got pissed off and left. I think it was Davenport West, left at halftime. But by then I did know that's what I wanted to do. So when I was 18 years old, which is fortunate, and I worked there off and on for 5 years. I commuted to Western. I didn't have any money. That's why I went there. I worked two jobs through college. Drove back and forth. My first job was in, I was hoping to talk to Drake a little bit. My first job was at the Muscatine Journal for 2 years in the 90s. And, you know, first time Muscatine had won, had a winning season in 34 years was my first year there.
Wow.
And being a Burlington kid, that wasn't all that great.
I was going to say, they're kind of, you know, they play each other, right? Yeah. Or they did.
They were rivals, yeah, back then. So I was like, damn. But no, that was fine. I was happy for him. But, and then, you know, but I always wanted to cover like the NFL, and I got an opportunity to do that for a while. I was sports editor of a paper in Missouri, just north of Kansas City, and got to cover the NFL for a while. And then, opportunity came up to work for the Cedar Rapids Gazette in 2006. And so joined forces with some of the best journalists that I've ever worked with, and Mark Morehouse and Mike Halas and some of the other people I worked with on that staff. And, you know, for a good 10 years or so, we were about as solid of a trio of reporters as you'll ever find. So, you know, not, yeah, about 10 years.
I would say so. Yeah. I would echo that for sure.
So, but yeah, that's how it kind of all came about. I mean, there were times I thought about something different. I was a coach once, when I was in college. I coached freshman football at Burlington, and it just kind of, not quite for me. But journalism seems to have been more in my wheelhouse.
And you've been with,
were you covering sports the entire time of your journal's career, or you said you, had a brief stint in politics, or?
Yeah. Early on, I would do, like when I was in Burlington working part time on the sports desk, I would also help out and do cops beat, you know, once in a while. I'd go and do some small things there, you know, and then I worked for a year in Fort Dodge doing police and county government and
Dirty Dodge.
Yeah. No kidding. Saw some stuff that kind of, you know, trials, saw a guy die. That was kind of rough one time. You know, he was working like on a truck or something, and all of a sudden, like the pickup truck just slammed down his head. You know, he was there. So I rushed over to see what happened, and I wish I wouldn't have, you know. And then when I was in Iowa early in 2006, I was doing kind of this enterprise, which is kind of more off the field stuff, and then also helping out on the news desk. So it was 06. It was the day that Iowa lost at Indiana in football. I had to go down to Bonaparte, where a kid like killed his whole family, like five people. And so I did some pretty rough stuff. And then, you know, I'd do some presidential candidates. I did the floods in 08. And so, you know, I've kind of always had that, my hand in some harder news and, you know, arrests. And so that was something I could do. And unfortunately, early on with Iowa, there were a lot of them. Fortunately, there haven't been as many over the last, you know, 15 years as there were from like 07 to 09, where it seemed like every other day there was something going on.
Sure.
You say harder news, but I gotta imagine, like, people are really emotional about their sports teams. Like, It's got to be a little bit difficult to write about when you're doing just more the recap, the stats, and what have you. You know, like you see some, like, especially in the last couple of years, like if you have like an even slightly bit of an unhappy fan base, like kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier with the 2020 stuff, like there are people who want you to take a harder stance or one way or the other. No.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the stuff with like,
Brian, I got it, Scott, I got it. Ask the tough questions, right?
Yeah, exactly. God. There you go.
And if I don't hear that line ever again, I'll be mad. But, you know, and I always say, we ask the questions, you don't like the answers, and you don't like the tone.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll watch a press conference like, I always joke about like Rocky V, and, you know, they're standing up, you're nothing, you know, who do you think you are? You know, and it's like, that's not what we're going to do. You know, do you think I'm going to stand up and point at Kirk Ferentz and go, why in the hell is your son still the offensive coordinator?
I was just going to say the discourse over the last couple of years with Brian, I passively from afar sort of observe the interactions that you have on social with some of your stories or some of the stuff that you put out, answers that you'll tweet out to questions that you or somebody asks at a Tuesday media availability. And it's like these people want you to fire or hire these coaches. Like, you, Scott Docterman, are in charge of personnel decisions for the Iowa staff. It's so nuts. And I think the response from Morehouse, the all-timer, eat shit, that's a Hall of Fame response by him. And I can't imagine how often you'd like to just tweet that back at somebody. But Kevin's right. I don't envy the responses and probably messages that you get on a lot of the stories that you do.
No, for sure. It got really bad for really the last 2 years with Brian, because people were angry. They were upset. And then they have their eyes, so they saw what didn't happen on the offensive side of the ball, and they're frustrated and they want to convey it. Well, you know, it's not like during the game Kirk's checking Twitter, you know, and so we're the ones that are there, so we're the ones that they feel like they can, you know, vent to. I always kind of call myself the community bartender, you know, come up with your problems, and that's what we do. But the issue was that after a while, I'm like, I can't do anything. I can't fire this guy. I mean, I could, you know, we can ask questions about aspects, and, you know, we can ask bigger probing questions, but it's not going to be the tone. We're not going to throw our anger, you know, channel what you're feeling, your frustration, into these questions. And I think times, you know, and I know there was one time over at Ohio State where Doug Lesmeray, who, you know, had, ask Kirk some, you know, pretty challenging pointed questions. But I always come back to this one, that if I was him and I was in his situation, I could do the same thing. But if you're there every single day, and I'm not saying you can't ask those questions, but you can't ask it with that tone. You can't ask him, pepper him the way that he did. And that's where, you know, you do have to be professional. And it's not that I'm scared that he's going to take away your press pass. Nothing like that. I mean, you know, I'm a member of the FWAA. I'm on the All-American Committee. I'm not afraid of anybody. But, you know, you do have to be cognizant and respectful, because for every loss, then there's a win. And then do you want me to, you know, and then their emotions change. And how dare you ask that? You know, it comes the next week.
Well, and it is important, too. I think about things like, I think the last two summers, your pod partner in Lystico got to sit down with Brian for 2-3 hours at a time and do these long, deep dive interviews. That I think the fan base has really enjoyed. By the way, your guys' podcast is awesome on the Iowa Everywhere Network. It's if there's one show I consistently tune into, it's you and Chad.
Thank you.
The people who actually know stuff, not our show, your show. And Chad doesn't get that without that professionalism and a little bit of an effort to, like, hey, I'm not trying to be the bad guy. And those coaches aren't dumb. Brian would tell you, Kirk would tell you, they know that you guys have a job to do too, and that it's not always going to be, you know, easy questions. And they understand that line. And if both parties understand that, then you get the cool stuff like the 3-hour summer deep dive. But like these, if you acted like some of these fans on Twitter wanted you to, you guys wouldn't get anything from these guys. And then in Iowa City, they're already tight. You know, they're not they don't want to give you a whole lot anyway. So yeah, that's tough.
I would say, you know, along those lines, that the last 2 years, last two summers, I got some really good access with Brian. And last year he said, I'll only do Scott. I'll only talk to Scott. And the year before, I had a 6 hour session with him where we went over game film.
Sure.
And I said, I want to see how you put together, you know, your game plans and what you're seeing so I can try to convey that.
Yeah.
And the two summers ago, what we did was I said, I want to see their best. And I want to give you three or four games where I'm like, you know, this didn't work. Yep. And so we went over Ohio State in 17, you know, you know, USC in 19, games that really measured up. And then games like the one I pointed to a lot, and I think it was a really pivotal game, was 20. Nobody was at Kinnick, but the 21-20 lost to Northwestern.
Bad.
You know, and
threw it 55 times.
Exactly. And I'm like, you have a quarterback starting his first game against that defense, who that defensive coordinator knows you better than you know yourself and every tendency you have. And you've got a quarterback, you know, struggling. Why aren't you running the ball a little bit more often? And that's where we actually kind of argued over that. And I think that's great. That's fair, you know, because my opinion was, especially later on, just run it. Just get a couple of yards, because the last interception, you're inside the 30.
Yeah.
You're down by a point. Your defense is playing well after kind of a tough second quarter. Just get a couple more yards. And then, you know, he's kind of mutters under his breath. He's like, well, we can't run against these guys, you know, and he was explaining why that they couldn't do that. And I'm like, this is music to my ears. Now I can also convey that to the people.
I was going
to
say
the best part.
When you get to, and of course you can't, not everybody's going to have that access, but when you get to sit down like that and you hear the explanation, you have time to go into why did we do this? Because we did this and this 3 quarters before. Is that eye opening? Is that sort of kind of a surreal moment to hear? Because, and we've tried to say it, and as many as of the fans want to argue that they're smarter in the game of football knowledge than Brian Ferentz is, the guy knows a lot of football, like probably forgot more than most fans know. Does that sort of, and I know you're not ever reporting with bias or opinion, you try to keep it fair, like you said, but like, does that start to puzzle piece some things together, at least that before were a little bit blurry?
Absolutely. I mean, it crystallizes for me that Brian Ferentz knows his stuff. And I know people right now are going, what, you know, but
yeah.
Okay. You know, there were issues, and there are major issues schematically and also personnel wise.
Yeah.
And then the injuries compounded all of that. That's really what has happened. They made some mistakes in recruiting, retention. There are all those factors that I do want to emphasize, but when I go in, you know, some of the things he explained, which were, you know, kind of like, hey, I'm an algebra student and he's teaching me calculus.
Yep.
And I'm trying to soak it in. That's really tough. But I did try to buy into that a little bit. And, you know, the Ohio State game was really eye-opening for, this is what we saw on film before. We thought we could do this. And so we spent the first quarter trading our tight ends to the other side to see how they reacted, because we expected them to do this. And so it's like, and then you would see a lot of, not necessarily unbalanced, but you would see sort of unbalanced looks at times where, okay, Hockenson and Fant trade over before even the pre-snap. And then, okay, they adjusted this way, exactly what we thought. And then I remember distinctly that early moment in the second quarter, he goes, we got him right where we want him. And then bam, you know, and you just see the second quarter, the floodgates open. And I'm like, that's a smart effing football coach there.
Yeah.
He knows his shit.
Sorry, we also had Hockenson and Fant, which it really helps to have those two.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been telling people, look, you know, between the two teams, there were 15 first or second round draft picks, and six of them were at Iowa.
That's crazy.
So it wasn't like it was a void of talent there at all. You know, Tristan Wirfs. I mean, Allar Jackson should have been a draft pick, and in today's world, he would have been, you know, with things that just been legalized. But, you know, all that being said, it's like, okay, now it matches. Now I see why. And then now you look at, but then you again, the complicated parts of the Northwestern game that, you know, in 20 is like, okay, I see why it's difficult. And then he's trying to explain to me why he can't run the ball. And I'm still like, yeah, but you're going to have to do something here. You know, you only need about three more yards and you got a perfect field goal and you're going to win 23-21. Then you're going to go to Indianapolis. And the way you're playing, the way you're playing at that end of that year would not have wanted to have been Ohio State. Maybe they pull it out, but that was as good of a team at the end of the year as I've seen out of this program.
I know it's unfortunate that year happened like it did. I've got a few other questions. A big topic before we get into some Iowa specific stuff. You had a great podcast with Chad. Recommend their podcast if it didn't come across earlier. This big old $2.8 billion payout by the NCAA and all this stuff happening with NIL and how the payers are going to get the players are going to get paid moving forward. What are the biggest implications from this, from your reporting side? Because it sounded like you had, I mean, obviously not all the details are out, but the way you sort of talked about it, you hit on a few things. I know when I was listening, I heard the sentence like walk-ons might go away, and that perked my ears up. I was like, oh, there's not going to be any more of us, you know? So what are the big implications here with this payout, and where do things go from here?
First of all, I hope you guys get some money out of this, because I think you're going to. I think it goes back, it's class action through like 2016. So, get a couple of checks out of them while you can.
Love that. The old coupon to Arby's coming right up.
There you go. You know, 59 cents. No, I think there's the ramifications. Let's start at the sports, individual sports, that instead now they have a different number between scholarship limits and roster limits. Scholarship limits, like for football, are 85, and there's really no limit to the number of walk-ons you can have, but for the most part it's between 110 and 120 for most programs. Yep. Total players, and then 35-ish walk-ons. Well, what this is going to do is establish a roster limit, and it's not going to be 85. It might be 100, might be 110, and then it's up to you to decide how many scholarships you get. Well, most schools, if they're smart, will fill that or come close to
everybody.
Yeah. And so if you have 105 or 100, let's say, they're going to want a scholarship, every single player there. Okay, that's great for football. Football deserves it. Football is the moneymaker. It makes, at Iowa, between 85 and 90% of all revenue comes directly from football.
Yep.
Now, where the implications lie for all the other sports is pretty significant.
Yeah.
Because then you start to go with the Title IX part of it, which is if you add 20 more scholarships to football, you've got to find probably 23 to 25 more for women's sports, or you reduce out of your men's sports pool.
I was going to say,
or you do both.
For a university, they're like, all right, we got to make some cuts.
Yes. And
yes, almost always going to be on the cut side more than the adding side.
Exactly. So
especially when they start throwing out like direct payments to players from universities, like you're not going to add back women's swimming and diving, or, you know, it's going to be men's golf might get cut or something else like that.
Well, Scott and Chad were talking about baseball.
That's my biggest fear, that you're going to see a reduction in baseball and wrestling across the board. Not at Iowa, all in wrestling for sure, no. But I mean, and then wrestling is another one. Now it's 9.9 scholarships. It might, Iowa wrestling may want to say, okay, the roster limit could be 30. They're probably not going to go with 30 scholarships, but they're probably going to do more than 9.9, yeah. You know, and so then you got to, again, take it away from somewhere else. And you've got to look at places where there are chunks, not just nickel and dimes. I mean, you know, they cut men's swimming and men's tennis and men's gymnastics the other couple of years ago. You know, what are you going to cut? Track and field? Or are you going to, you know, I mean,
yeah,
or
you, track and field team, better not.
Are you going to add 25 scholarships? Maybe you do it with women's basketball. Maybe you try to minimize it. But then you get, again, then the payments come in, you know, the $20 million or whatever, roughly. And I think where it's going to be decided in the courts at some point is, does that need to be proportionate to male to female ratio? What Title IX is and provides opportunity, or does Title IX automatically just say it provides opportunity, not payment? And if it provides payment, then we know football and men's basketball is going to get 85 to 90% of that, because that's why collectives are in place. Right. It's to get the quarterback. It's to get the you know, forward or whatever. But if it's proportionate to male and female population, and out of the $10 million, 9.5 is going to go to the men's basketball and football. And so you might have a male track athlete get $1,500. You might have a female track athlete get $45,000, you know?
Yeah, that's insane to think about that. Gosh, so this is going to get sticky for the universities.
Yeah, I just don't know. And so it's going to come to it down to a lawsuit. And I think that's fair. It probably should in this way, because how do you define that money, that split? Because is it fair to go men, women equal, or is it, hey, we're going to do it by marketability. We've provided the opportunity. Now it's up to the marketability to establish how much money each athlete gets. And then this, you know, and my fear is that when you cut it equally between men and women, the collectives are just going to continue to be there.
Yeah.
Because let's face it, they're there to get the best players for football and men's basketball. So if you can't have any advantage, you're going to have to supplement it somehow.
Yeah.
But ultimately it's good, because I think there's been way too much pressure put upon fans in recent years with collectives. I mean, you're asking, buy the tickets, join the I Club, support our student athletes. And then, oh, by the way, contribute, and pay for them to do this and get this player. And you're like, man, I'm getting tapped out here.
It's relentless.
So like, you know, and when you're looking and you're saying, man, next year we're going to get $13 million more from the Big Ten because of our new network deal. Why can't you just take it out of that? You know? And I think that's fair, because, you know, fans have been tapped out for a long time, you know, the big donors, sure. And, you know, that's one thing, but Joe fan who's got season tickets, who likes to tailgate, and he's got a couple of kids and maybe one in college, and he's like, I can give you $100, but that's
yeah, exactly. But what's that doing for you? That's, they ain't doing nothing, right?
No, I hate that the fans feel like it's on them, mm-hmm. or we're gonna suck. Or like, yeah, the Hawks are going to suck if I don't give them $2,000 this year. Like, that's not the way it should be. So that is crazy. Roster limits versus scholarship limits. I mean,
it makes sense though, right? Because if otherwise you can just supplement an unlimited roster with
NIL, sure, right? Yeah. No, it does. It's just, it looks a whole lot different than it did in 2013. that's for sure.
It's not the same sport.
Yeah, no. It's different. It's different.
It's not the same sport.
But I'm happy that there are NIL opportunities. All of you guys could have benefited from it, whether it's have a camp in your hometown to, you know, go out and, you know, reading books to school kids to, you know, hey, you got the Polecat Porter. you could have benefited financially from that. And
then, I had $0 from that.
You had nothing. And
there always was like valid reasons for NIL. And they just knew if they opened it up, like, it would get bastardized just the way it did. And that's when they fought it for so long. And once they couldn't stop fighting, it's like, hey, this is how it's going to be. Like, I don't think anyone was really ever against the idea of, yes, Cade McNamara can go back to his hometown and do a camp for kids and stuff like that and collect $20 a head or whatever, you know, or sign some autographs. But it was always going to be the loophole to what it's become now, and it's what it is pay for play, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure. And that's part of it. I always looked at it, even going way back to not only when you guys were there, but guys before you. And I always thought, you know, I remember Mitch King's 47 jersey, and I'm going to Shields at the mall, and that's the first one you see, or number 7 with Marvin McNutt, or, you know, and I always thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool if Josie Jewell could do a, you know, for Finn and Feather, do a commercial or something like that.
Oh,
that's what NIL is all about. You know, it's like, because you guys are at the height of your marketability when you're athletes at the University of Iowa. Yep. Even some that go on to pros are still more more marketable as Iowans. And and that's why I always thought it was so unfair that, you know, you're 22, 23 years old and you could go out and make really good money, which they are now, versus when you're 25 or 26 and maybe your NFL career is over and you come back to the area and it's like, you're not even going to make $100 signing autographs now.
Yeah.
That's really unfair.
I want to segue quick to someone who's pretty marketable, Caitlin Clark. I want you to try to put into words what it was like to cover her as an athlete at the University of Iowa, or just be in the ecosystem with a player like that, and what she's meant to the university. And then if you could, I'd be interested in, assuming she's one of them, since your time's covering the Hawks, is there a Mount Rushmore of Iowa athletes that you could put together?
Yeah, that's great. I would say that covering her was unlike anything I've ever covered, no matter where I've been, because you just saw her as a, she was a rock star. Everywhere she went, whether it went at Carver, and you'd see 1,000 little girls, and you'd hear these high pitched Caitlin, Caitlin, Caitlin voices, you know, everybody wanting an autograph or anything. And they're like, oh, you know, and to see, you know, on the road, I think what really opened my eyes more than anything was, I think they were at Northwestern this year, and I didn't go, but I saw one of the, I think it was the ABC affiliate in Chicago, went just to talk to people going into the game, because Northwestern women's basketball get 1200 fans a game, yeah, maybe, you know, and to see it's not only sold out, but it was like $500 a ticket. And then you saw all these, I would say like 14-year-old girls, 15-year-old girls who play basketball. And it was like, we get to see her. They were so excited. This is my birthday present. This is, you know, what we all wanted to do. And all these people go there. And it really got me thinking that, you know, throughout time, we see these historical figures, you know, Barack Obama, and you see a young boy who looks up and says, one day I could be like you. I could be president of the United States. And, but it's also, it applies here, that because a lot of times girls who look like Caitlin Clark from the suburbs of west of, you know, west Des Moines or the Chicago west suburbs or whatever, and they play these games, they don't necessarily have a hero they could look up to. But here she is, that she can prove she's everything she is. She's a Catholic kid. She, you know, she's, you know, from well-to-do family, but she works really hard, and she's can have swagger, and she can play the way she does, and be as entertaining and as, you know, energetic. And I think for 14-year-old girls, it's like, wow, that's my hero. That's who I want to be like. And it's really cool to be able to see that and witness that, just, you know, shooting star in some respects. And I think we all knew it, you know, especially after Browner's sophomore year, that this was the trajectory, but it still got bigger than I ever thought it would. As far as a Mount Rushmore goes, you know, it's funny because in football, there were so many really good All-American players. It's hard to pick,
yeah,
you know, who's better than who. Is Brandon Scherff better than Robert Gallery, or is he better than, you know, Tristan Wirfs? And then
Mount Rushmore, just of offensive linemen.
Yeah. Kevin Ward was up there. He was.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe like if there's like a small little sandcastle right next to Mount Rushmore.
You're right. You could probably do just football, but I mean.
But what I was meaning was, I don't know that I could put a football player on it.
Yeah.
Because that, even though there are so many great athletes, and almost at just about every position, that they've had an All-American, which really speaks to the prowess of Kirk Ferentz and his coaching staff to be able to develop players like that. And, you know, from a Sean Green to a, you know, Brad Banks and Marvin McNutt, and then all the tight ends and the offensive linemen, and, you know, guys like Josie and Jack Campbell and the defensive backs. It's just a remarkable, but I don't know that I could put anybody in that top four. And the top four is almost kind of easy. And a few years ago, it wouldn't have been. And for me, it's Caitlin. She's George Washington's face. There's no question about that in my mind. I would put Spencer Lee. I think he's the best wrestler I've ever seen.
Yep.
Most exciting athlete. Tony Ramos was pretty cool too. And Brett Metcalf, but I think, you know, he'll prove it in Paris next month. I believe
he promised us a couple episodes ago that he would. So
yeah, and he will. Three and four are a little bit different. I would say Megan Gustafson. I thought she was just amazing. She was the number one player for me until Caitlin came, and it's kind of unfortunate she didn't get to live in that, you know, moment long enough. And then finally, I would go Luca Garza. And even though Keegan Murray is a better pro, he left after a second year. And you do have to reward somebody who has a career and 4-year career, 2-time you know, player of the year nationally. I mean, it's really remarkable what he was able to accomplish. And you look back in Iowa's history, and they hadn't had a consensus first-team All-American since the 50s before he did it twice. And he's, what, seventh or eighth in all-time in Big Ten scoring. And so I thought he had just an outstanding career. So it's hard for me to put a football player above them, even though that's the sport I cover and I'm, you know, closer to the players and kind of see their strengths. And, you know, there's just so many great stories. I mean, I really kind of, like the coaches, I really enjoy seeing them come in as freshmen. And all of a sudden it's like you went from being, you know, 6'1", 205 to 6'2", 240 and just lighten people up. I mean, I think it's great.
I think I'd have to agree with you on that. It would be really hard to put a football player up there. I'm not even sure.
Would be your top one even. Sheriff was the highest drafted in that time, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, recency bias says Jack Campbell to me, but I don't think he's on the same level when you think about impact. I mean,
no, I mean you're talking if we're talking players of the year, three-time national champ, and
I mean, Caitlin's literally an A-list celebrity. Yeah. Like, no one's on her. Like, there's a sub. There's a. What's crazy to me? You mentioned the little girls wearing her jersey. The subculture that's developed across general society around Caitlin Clark, not even sports fans, but just your everyday person, is crazy. And then it's not just little girls. I will drive around my neighborhood, take my daughter to daycare when school was still in session, and I'd come back. And in the morning before jumping on the bus, there would be little boys wearing Caitlin Clark jerseys.
There's grown men just walking around.
Yep. Caitlin Clark. Well, sure. I mean, but, you know, little boys still have that, like, you know, they've got heroes that they would openly wear a jersey for, and it's Caitlin Clark. Like,
that is the biggest change that I've ever seen in sports. Yeah. You know, just to go from when I was a kid, certainly, and even when you guys were in college or before, you would never see a boy wearing a female jersey. It had to be a special reason, like that was my sister or something like that, and she's getting her jersey retired or something. To see young boys, to see men wearing 22. I heard stories, you know, one friend of mine told me his 10-year-old son was in a league and he shot a three and he threw his hands up like this and was going up the court. And he immediately goes, oh, was that for Jordan? You know, Michael Jordan used to do that. And goes, no, Caitlin Clark. And I'm like, wow, people are looking at Caitlin Clark and they're not seeing gender. They're seeing cool. They're seeing awesome. And I think that's really, you know, that's transcendent. And it's really amazing to witness. And so, you know, I think that's why it's just, I don't think we've ever seen or, you know, in my lifetime, I don't think I'll see another person that matches her in charisma and effect of, you know, to go and break every television record in the WNBA and in college basketball and every attendance record. I mean, you look at the difference in attendance when she's there versus when she's not. And it's, you know, and of course there's the whole WNBA situation, which has really caused me to back way off on Twitter. Cause I just don't want to get,
oh my God. It's the most toxic thing I've ever been a part of. I mean, I'm not even a part of it. Just witnessing it makes me feel gross. Yeah. I think, and it'll be very hard to do and it's hard to even quantify or really determine, but if there's one person who as an athlete at the University of Iowa is going to surpass Niall Kinnick, which is really hard to do, especially because he has this, you know, military like war hero lore to him, I think it's Caitlin. I don't think you can even determine that for another 20 or 30 years, but as far as impact and like what they, I think Caitlin might be even number one all time. And that's a really hard debate that could never be settled, but that's my opinion. And I don't think we'll ever see. I think it's a once in a several lifetime sort of athlete, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to put that together too and try not to be hyperbolic and take things in perspective because now Kinnick's shadow, I mean, the stadium's named after him. I mean, and if he
I still think it could be Clark Arena in 40 years.
Not unless she writes a $40 million check to the university. They ain't giving out names for free anymore.
Yeah, but maybe
$28 million shoe deal.
I think there, that stat where the Gable statue was might be a good spot to have her throw up her arms or something like that, you know, right out there. But
yes,
but you'd wait for a few years and you do that so then people could come and spend money and you know, on a game or whatever. But no, I mean, you know, Niall Kinnick, again, his shadow is looms so large, but in a different way, she is bigger because Niall Kinnick's is narrowed to the Iowa fan base and to, you know, and, but you also look at it, we look at it with what could have been, you know, he lost his life during, you know, the most epic struggle in human history and tragically died. And we always talk about what he could have done, what he could have been governor, like his grandfather, or maybe even president. And it's endless because of how smart he was. But I look at Caitlin Clark and I see some of the same strengths. I listen to her and I just, you know, you're overwhelmed with how she carries herself at her age. It's like she's 22 and she's a polished professional. Yeah. And I wonder in 20, 25 years, is she going to A, either be running her own company or B, will she be an elected official? And I'm not going to get into the party part of it, but she can handle herself. And then she could come back to Iowa and be governor or senator or whatever. Absolutely. You know, she's got that kind of charisma and she's well-spoken and articulate and brilliant, obviously. And has the name recognition that I think the sky's the limit for her. She might be a billionaire. She might be like LeBron or Michael Jordan or Tiger Woods when it comes to revenue generated by the time her career ends.
She also might be able to coach the Fever better than Christy Sides right now. So I don't want to keep you too long. Last topic, we'll swing it around to Iowa football. On the most recent podcast with Chad, I heard you talking about, you know, Tim Lester. We got the new face. Finally, we got, you know, what we think people want. Although there was some pushback on Lester's hire as well over some other options. Always going to be. The players, we're starting to hear, you know, you guys are getting some opportunity to interview the players, interview some of the coaches, hear what is different about this new offense, what's Lester going to do that's going to change things around. Players seem to, you know, that a lot more opportunities. We're doing, you know, there's rumblings and it's off season, but it is right about June, July where things start to build into that hype for the season. I heard about completion percentage from you. I heard about red zone efficiency, yards per carry, some stats that you threw out on the latest podcast. What is legitimately what should a fan expect from this Iowa football team in 2024?
Well, when I look at the offense, and you guys know this better than almost every fan, and this is kind of how I expect it is. It's the smallest details that will create the biggest impression. And for me, because I kind of dig offensive line play and I really like to watch it, it's how do you create an advantage up front that enables everything to go around it. And what I like is, and I've kept track and I do it myself. I don't use like PFF or anything, you know, how they perform with like jet sweeps and just the motion itself, how it just changes. And, you know, and Kevin can tell me I'm full of shit or whatever, but it seems to me that it forces the second level to just have that slight hesitation. And as we know, if there's a slight hesitation, then the offensive line has a little bit more of an advantage. And I can't tell you how many times that I saw it. And I know you guys saw it, that the blocks would be very close to being there. They're just a step, a fraction of a step. And every time, I mean, like the yards per carry were like two difference, like 3.3 without motion, you know, with motion, 5.35 with jet sweep motion. So if you're doing that on each and every play, and I talked to one assistant, he's like, I think it was out of a 67 play scrimmage, like 59 included some sort of motion. And he goes, what it did was it wrecked our fits on defense. And if you can do that over and over and over again, as we know with this is the way it's always been. You get that one wrong fit at the right time and bam, and they've got good running backs. I'm pretty confident in that.
I love our stable of running backs.
I mean, I think you know, Caleb Johnson just looks the part. I mean, you know, big, strong, athletic. LaShawn Williams, underestimate him at your own value, you know, cause he's a tough kid. And then I think Kamari Moulton might be a breakout star, you know, really quick and everything. So I think it all plays out from that. And then also, I mean, they completed 60% of their passes when they had jet motion, even with Deacon Hill. And so if you have that kind of motion with a much more even if you have a quarterback like Cade, who is much more accurate, and you're putting that motion in, because again, the safety, doesn't spot it, or the linebacker's not in place, and then somebody's out here. So my expectation, it isn't real like big as far as like, oh, they're going to score a touchdown a game or anything like that. Although they should, it's more, how do you do in those situations? And that's why I kind of identified like four areas on offense. Yards per carry seem to matter because it's cumulative. It just, it's like, you know, constant body blows in a fight. Third down percentage, you know, you got to convert third downs, you know, to keep drive alive. Red zone touchdown percentage. You've got to make sure when you're in the red zone, you scored touchdowns, you're not kicking field goals. And we've seen it both ways with Iowa before. And then finally, it's completion percentage. You got to complete those passes. And there have been a lot that haven't been completed. The last one to hit 60 in a season was CJ Beathard in 15. So if they can move incrementally, maybe get to 60, maybe 4.4 yards per carry, you know, touchdown percentage be in the top half in the country, you know, third down percentage be in the top half in the country. If you could get to that number with this defense, with this schedule, Iowa's going to be hosting a playoff game in December. Now, if you can't, or if there's injuries, which is always the asterisk, then, you know, you can struggle because you just can't have what you had last year. Because 10-4 with that type of offense, man, you good luck.
It's a fairy tale.
Yeah, it's a once every 5 years thing.
Yeah, it's. I look at the schedule, and I heard you guys go through it too. Like it's about as favorable as you could get in the new Big Ten. I'm looking at this Iowa State game in week two. Is Iowa State, you know, if you're going to go through them and be like, let's rank the importance of these games this year. Is Iowa State the most important game on the schedule? Because you could argue, and I know we don't like to do this. Kevin punched me in the face. Yep. You know, as a player, you go into every game thinking you're going to win. I'll put on my journalist media cap in this. Let's say that more times out of not, we don't beat Ohio State. Mm-hmm. Every other game is very winnable. Mm-hmm. And that Iowa State game early on is always so tricky because it takes a few games, a few weeks, new offensive coordinators especially, to get into the flow. There is a very possible scenario where that Iowa State game, looking back in hindsight, about November comes around and it's like, ooh, that was a big one to get, especially because of what Iowa State could be this year. Do you feel the same?
I do. I think they right now, based on the schedule, that's probably the second best opponent on the schedule. Yeah. And I usually don't say that about Iowa State, usually about fourth or somewhere around there. But this year, they return more production than any other team in the country, 86% of their production.
Wow.
You return a quarterback that had 3,000 yards. You return, you know, a really pretty good defense. There's a lot of players that are productive. They're back receivers, you know, Higgins and Knoll and up, you know, they have a really good young tight end and Ben Bramer. I mean, they have a lot of really good players, and they have a good coach because when it looked like it was trending down, and last year, as bad as the gambling situation was for Iowa, it was doubly so for Iowa State football. I mean, they lost quarterback, their best running back, you know, defensive tackle, tight end, left tackle, and they were still able to go to a bowl game, and they won some pretty good games down the stretch. So, you know, the game's in Iowa City, but they won in Iowa City last time. I think, as you mentioned, that this game broadly has more implication than it maybe ever has because of the playoff being expanded. Yep. That, you know, I brought up this scenario, and it could have big ramifications beyond you know, if even if Iowa wins, because Iowa, let's say they go 10-2, they get stung somewhere and then they beat or lose to Ohio State. Iowa State can go on, win its conference and get a bye and be one of the top four teams. And Iowa could get left out even if they beat Iowa State. So, boy, that would be some traffic here, especially in central Iowa. But
that would be
it would be fun to be a beat writer in that situation, huh?
No, my. It'd be. But I think both teams should be ranked. I think by the end of the year, both teams will be very, very good, on the fringe at worst of being a playoff discussion team, top 20, top 15 possibly. So, but I also think Iowa understands, and then losing at home 2 years ago, you know, I'm sure it's always funny to me, because whenever I get asked about Iowa's rivalries, I'm like, they're four and they're all kind of important in their own way. It's hard to really punch one forward, but in central Iowa, it seems like the Cy-Hawk lives every single day. Out in eastern Iowa, it's kind of like, well, they're all kind of that ballpark.
I would agree. I won't ask any more questions. We've already taken up too much of your time. Grant, if you have anything you want to throw in there, pop in, shoot a nice question over to Scott before we leave.
Yeah, Scott, I'm curious, who's got some of the best and worst press boxes you've seen in your career? I know people dog on Indiana's press row for their basketball stadium. They send you guys up to the moon. But like, what are some of the good ones, the bad ones? What do you see over there?
I would say the best, you know, Iowa's both are not bad, and their parking is great. So I'm not going to complain about Iowa.
Parking a big factor.
It is. Well, compared to Wisconsin, where I turned them into the FWAA, because, I mean, we have to park 1.2 miles away. Oh. And for some 50-year-old fat guy like me, that sucks. But for I really fear for, like, you know, some of the female reporters, you know, and it's a night game and they've got to walk that far in downtown and they're 25. And, you know, I mean, that's really not cool. They should have some sort of shuttle system or something like that. And so the parking situation, I would say Wisconsin, then Northwestern is being the worst too. But as far as press boxes go, Wisconsin is so old that when they do the jump around, you feel like you're going to fall. It's like literally like this. And I think it was Morehouse who did a video of it once. He put his coffee cup there and you could just see the spilling, you know, because of just how it feels. It's like, man, this place is 100 plus years old. You kind of worry. And plus they don't have heat in the front row. so when you're playing in November and it's like 40 and it's rainy and you're kind of getting wet in there. I would say Nebraska is great. Maybe you don't want to hear that, but that's true. Purdue is fantastic.
We echo that from a stadium standpoint as well. They just have a great facility over there.
Yeah. Northwestern's not very good, but of course it got destroyed, so that's good. Basketball wise, Northwestern was the old arena was terrible, where we used to have to, I mean, that'll go way back. I used to have a flip phone and I have to turn it on so I can learn to find the place, the outlet to plug in your laptop up in the top rafters.
That's amazing.
And then finally they gave us lamps, but even then you still couldn't do it. And as you know, I'd say Penn State sucks too for their press box. It's just god awful. You have to climb over people to get to your seat and that sort of thing. So yeah, Maryland's all right. Rutgers is okay. I mean, so I'm looking forward to going out west, you know, the Rose Bowl and some of those places.
That'll be fun.
Yeah.
No.
Anything else, Grant?
No, I mean, you guys kind of have to steal all the questions. I was going to dive into it.
But, that's how we do it around here. I take all the good ones. Scott, thank you so much for your time tonight. Did not mean to go 20 minutes over, but we have good conversation. You have great answers, tons of insight. And like I said, we respect your stuff. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be the third member of the Iowa media crew to have an appearance on your show.
Third one's the charm.
I think the fourth, right? We had Kenny on, right, too?
Oh, yeah, Kenny.
Did we did have Kenny on, didn't we? I forgot about it. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, hopefully.
He's my teammate at the Athletic now.
I know.
When Rushmore, though.
When we had Morehouse on, it was like 8 days later that all that stuff happened in 2020. So hopefully no major event within the ecosystem of the Iowa Hawkeyes happens after we have you on. Nonetheless, hope everybody listening enjoyed the show. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. We'll be back again next week. I'm trying to get Pat Anger on. We got to talk about the new gig. how he's gonna tone himself down for that one. But anyway, thank you guys. I'll talk to you next time. Peace.
Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you want more, you can check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube by searching Washed Up Walk-Ons. And if you're interested in supporting the show, head over to patreon.com/washedupwalkons, where you can find bonus podcasts, merchandise, and other cool perks. Best part, half of your subscription benefits the kids at UI Children's Hospital. We'll see you next time. Hawks by a million.